You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new study found that eating eggs may be tied to higher cholesterol and an increased risk of heart disease. We'll talk about the ongoing back and forth over eggs and what we as consumers can do when studies on food seem to say different things. First, a mass shooting at two New Zealand mosques last week killed 50 people and left 50 injured. The shooting targeted Muslim immigrants and has again raised questions about social media outlets and their role in radicalization online. At a speech before New Zealand's parliament, Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern said social media companies need to start taking responsibility for content on their sites. Here's a listen.
We cannot simply sit back and accept that these platforms just exist and that what is said on them is not the responsibility of a place where they are published. They are the publisher, not just the postman.
Brian Levin is a professor of criminal justice and director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino. Brian, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me, Rob.
How does social media play into radicalization, whether we're talking about a white supremacist like the one apparently involved in this shooting or in, say, ISIS-inspired violence?
Well, you know, what is so interesting is how extremists have evolved using all kinds of media, going back to 100 years ago when the Klan relaunched on the Atlanta premiere of the first full-length motion picture, Birth of a Nation. Since then, obviously, we've had other forays. So in 1985, the first Aryan-based bulletin board, LibertyNet, started here in the United States. And then in 1995, we had Stormfront. And that was really something that enabled as a spoke-in-a-wheel kind of relationship to help white nationalists around the world connect. Since then, what has happened has been a more robust social media landscape, which has also become diversified and splintered during a time that nationalism has risen just when we've had sociopolitical fracturing. So we had three things, really: the evolution and fragmentation of social media. On top of that, we saw fragmentation within society, and these extremist groups can use that wedge to get in as a legitimate alternative to mainstream alternatives, particularly at a time when we've seen a five-decade decline in trust in the communal institutions that hold us together, like the courts, Congress, the media, academia, financial markets, etc.
Now, this has been called a shooting in some ways, not just inspired by, but designed for social media live video streaming, the so-called manifesto posted on a website known for being one of the ugliest places on the internet. This is a case where someone was very much hoping to use this event and social media to advertise and maybe inspire others.
You know why I love doing your show? Because it's almost as if we rehearsed this in advance and we didn't. That was actually a point I was making for something I was writing independently. And that is, we not only, you're exactly spot on. We saw social media become something more than just a blank easel to more of a vehicle. And within the white nationalist movement in particular, there have been certain things that make it able to leverage social media more. One is their evolving relationship with the mainstream and how if they jettison some of their more horrific Nazi and Klan symbols and trade it for identitarianism or it's okay to be white or protect Western civilization, that's something that'll sell a little more. And when you have 9% of Americans, according to an ABC Washington Post poll from 2017, 9% saying Nazi views are acceptable, that is a decent swath. Furthermore, you have 14% in another poll, Reuters Ipsos, that said whites are under attack and people of color aren't. So in a fragmented socio-political landscape, we also have a fragmented social media landscape. And what that's allowed is the internet to ensnare a whole set of people around the world. And it's part of what they call propaganda of the deed. So in the past, you'd advertise someone else's violence. Now you're advertising your own. And indeed, the Norway shooter, whose name I don't want to give, was going to stream his attack over YouTube, but didn't. Now, each of them are leaving manifestos and mentioning prior extremist killers, in particular ones that have been from far-flung places like Norway or South Carolina. So indeed, what happens is social media is making icons out of terrorists who are then programming their attacks as delivery systems for not only manifestos, but for the violence itself, which is known as propaganda of the deed with respect to white nationalists and skinheads. Racist skinheads.
Talking to Brian Levin, professor of criminal justice at California State University, San Bernardino, about last week's shootings, terrorist shootings in New Zealand, and how ideologies and inspiration for violence are spread sometimes on social media. You mentioned saying the perpetrators' names. I want to go back to New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern. She talked some about this issue. Here's a little of what she had to say.
He sought many things from his act of terror, but one was notoriety, and that is why you will never hear me mention his name. He is a terrorist. He is a criminal. He is an extremist. But he will, when I speak, be nameless.
Brian, can you talk about the value of not repeating the perpetrator's name?
Absolutely. And what we've seen as a phenomenon since Columbine, or the University of California Santa Barbara area attacks, and others, where these folks have become folk heroes in certain violent, unstable segments of digital media. And it is unfortunate, but one of the things that we have to understand is that social media is not only being manipulated by foreign actors, but by violent extremists among us, and that is going to be a new challenge, and we're seeing increasing calls across the world for some kind of regulation. I'm not saying that exactly what that may or should be, but that is what is now coming on to the landscape with respect to national security. On the other hand, we have to remember one thing. We've seen a migration of extremists away from traditional places like Facebook, although they're still on, to other alternatives like Gab and Telegram and the Russian Facebook known as VK. So what we end up doing is creating a conundrum. The more we push for enforcement, the more we'll be creating an echo chamber in an already sloped pull towards a more fragmented, affinity-based internet. And I don't just mean cats playing the piano. I mean some evil things, as well as one that deals with direct person-to-person communication. That's where we're going. And indeed, Facebook announced initiatives in their own website for that kind of non-public person-to-person communication. That's where we're going, a more splintered and fragmented world that is supplemented by a more splintered and polarized and fragmented internet.
We're talking to Brian Levin with the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino. We're talking about how radicalization happens and the role of social media outlets and the news media after the mass shooting in New Zealand. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What, if anything, do you want to see from social media companies when it comes to racist or hateful content on their platforms, things that can verge on recruitment or incitement to violence? Is it something they should try to control? Or do you worry that could end up leading to a policing of political speech online? What do you want to see from how news outlets cover these events? And what do you want to see from political leaders reacting to shootings like this? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas at wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about radicalization after the mass shooting in New Zealand, how it happens, how social media and the internet play a role in spreading it. Brian Levin is with us from the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino. You can join in with your questions and thoughts at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the way we in the news media cover these events? What about the tone in certain online communities? And do you think social media companies should intervene and stop different forms of hateful or racist speech? Where should companies draw the line? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Brian, there's been some attention on YouTube, people saying the algorithms there kind of keep leaning people, nudging people toward more extreme things. So if you come on and watch a video that looks liberal, they might push you toward more radical liberal things. If you look at something that's conservative, they might push you toward more radical conservative things. That's what starts showing up in your feed, and sort of without noticing it, you're being drawn further and further to an extreme. What do you think about that?
Well, there is an actual historical example of this, and that is the Charleston church shooter who massacred 9 innocent parishioners at the Mother Emanuel Church in June of 2015. Initially did a search on black crime and was sent to the Council of Conservative Citizens, which is a button-down hate group, but nonetheless one that U.S. Senator Trent Lott addressed some years ago. So what we see is kind of a funnel approach. And to the extent that there is some kind of random tilting that includes conspiracy or bigotry, we should try to make sure that at the very least, searchers know what they're getting, as well as having this tailored for a general audience that is probably not looking for what I would say is deceptive type of material. In other words, there was a website that purported to be a memorial to the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, and it was put together by white supremacists. So in the same way that utilities have to make sure there's a routinization and standardization with the services they deliver, I think the same thing is true with regard to social media. I want to be careful here. I don't necessarily think that it should be done on the basis of content, but I do think, as the Supreme Court has found, regulating viewpoint is one thing, but time, place, manner, as well as truth in labeling is another, whether it's a cigarette pack or whether it's the internet. And I think there's a lot of mystery with regard to how searches work, how they can be in some way reformed to get a more accurate view of the most trustworthy information without having deceitful or bigoted people trying to skew or game the system.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Andy is with us in Westby. Andy, hello.
Hey, how's it going, guys? Yeah, this is terrible, all these shootings and stuff. But, I mean, when push comes to shove, more people are killed by hammers and knives and automobiles than assault rifles. And in regards to, you know, who's gonna be the disseminator and decider of what is bigoted speech? Because as it stands now, the Southern Poverty Law Center labels people bigots who, Gavin McInnes, for instance, who is just, he's just a goofy guy, comedian. He says provocative things.
Wait, you're factually incorrect, though. You're factually incorrect. I don't mind you having an opinion, but I think even a rudimentary search with regard to Mr. McInnes talking about non-whites is easily found with a lot of the good journalists who cover him. So that's factually incorrect. I'm not going to get into a debate about whether the Southern Poverty Law Center labels something or not. But what I can tell you is, with regard to some of the groups that they pointed out, and you can go ask them, I don't work for them, but what I can tell you is that some of these groups, for instance, were founded by eugenicists and have at various times had contractors and people who posted things that said Latinos were intellectually inferior. And I think it's worthwhile to point that out. None of us, by the way, in this conversation talked anything about guns, But yes, absolutely. As a matter of fact, assault weapons in the United States, or rifles overall, are responsible for deaths in the mid-hundreds. However, what we are seeing is a shift to greater and greater fatalities in mass shootings, such as Las Vegas. And that's something that I think should be on the table with regard to discussion. But I don't think any of us even brought up guns.
Andy brought up a point that a lot of people are looking at with the white supremacist online movement. The irony, the, oh, we're just joking, oh, you're overreacting, liberals, is often the exact language. And that's kind of a gray area, and people pointed that to that, in effect, as a recruitment tool. Do you have thoughts on that, Brian?
Well, look, here's the thing. Bottom line is, I think to the extent possible, we want to allow as many viewpoints into the marketplace of ideas. However, internet service providers have their own terms of service because they want to create a certain kind of climate for the people who inhabit their social media areas. And they have a right to enforce that. There are also many affinity-based, in other words, focusing on one type of either political movement or social exercise. That's where the internet is going. So I think, you know, whether or not it's right or wrong to regulate, you know, with terms of service, the internet is going to a more fragmented environment where affinity-based and person-to-person platforms are going to gain more and more share, just like we've seen with regard to cable television and satellite TV. So the bottom line is, I think as a community, and this is an important point, I'm not saying everything needs to be regulated either by contract or even by law. I'm pretty much a First Amendment person. But nevertheless, I think we can have leaders that are going to use verbiage that will encourage civic cohesion rather than dividing it. And I think two quick examples were President George Bush spoke 6 days after 9/11 about tolerance for Muslims. Hate crimes dropped by 2/3 the next day against Muslims and 2/3 in the next year. But when candidate Trump, 5 days after the San Bernardino terrorist attack, spoke, hate crimes against Muslims and Arabs increased above the already elevated number that we saw in the days after the terror attack. So it appears that particularly around conflictual or emotional events, the words of leaders can make a difference. And I think we should encourage all leaders to do so.
Talking to Brian Levitt from the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino, about social media, the media, and the mass shooting in New Zealand. Back to your calls now. Nathan is with us in Waconago. Nathan, hello.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
I just wanted to bring up how I kind of disconnected from social media over a year ago and gotten outside, lots of sun, and it's never made me happier. And maybe that's a piece of advice we should be giving people about how they can disconnect and talk to their neighbor and, you know, enjoy life around them instead of online.
Nathan, thanks for the call. Brian, do you think that just social media, there's something about it that's inherently negative or we'd all be happier without it?
No, because there are a lot of benefits. People are connecting. They are sharing actual information. Look, in the same way that drunk driving doesn't mean that we should eliminate driving, we should eliminate the drunks who drive from being able to harm others. And I think that's a lesson we can learn with regard to the information superhighway. But the bottom line is, I think we have to be very careful in our good intentions. And I think the first caller actually had a very good point. And that is, we should be able to discuss changes that are going on in society. We should be able to discuss political, social, moral, and cultural changes and how we feel about it. But what I do think that there is a certain coarseness that has developed along with the immediacy. And we know that on top of that, evil people like extremists and foreign governments are trying to use social media to divide us. Indeed, listen to this. This is really interesting. November 2016, election month, was the worst month since the first anniversary of 9/11 Jim Nolan of West Virginia University and I have found. The day after election day was the worst day going back to 2003. And guess what? the Russians tripled their racially divisive ad buys, according to USA Today and the House Democrats and the Homeland Security Committee found that they tripled their racially divisive ad buys in the few months just before the election. I'm not saying that that necessarily caused it, but they were sophisticated enough to think that maybe they could influence things in some way, and there were millions of exposure to these kinds of phony websites that tried to divide people on issues like race, immigration, and police use of force.
Brian, in our last minute or so, stepping away from media, we've talked to you about different forms of terrorist violence, different causes of it. Are we as a nation, as a government, paying close enough attention to white supremacy as a source of terrorist violence?
No. And what's so interesting, in the minute I have left, our data has shown that homicides that are ideologically motivated by white nationalists have risen. Ideologically motivated homicides by violent Salafist jihadists have dropped to just one last year. Look, anyone who has an ideological beef is going to be able to commit a mass act of terrorism. It could be tomorrow, and it could be anyone, including someone who has a hybrid mix of idiosyncratic grievances. But the bottom line is, as far as movements that are out there, white nationalists are the most international, the most widely dispersed, among the most internet savvy. And when you look at some of the opinion polls, whether it's 9% of Americans saying Nazi views are acceptable, or far right, not conservative, but far right parties in Europe routinely polling in the double digits, as well as increased engagement on the internet. And as Andrew Thompson wrote in Rolling Stone about 4chan, increased use of these epithets on the darker corners of the net, what we're looking at is a more public engagement by white nationalists who will be across a spectrum ranging from over the top horrible symbols all the way to more muted, amorphous messages, but both are about preserving Western civilization from an invasion of foreigners, many of whom are non-Christian and people of color.
We'll leave it there for now. Brian, thanks for joining us today.
As always, thank you so much. Always enjoy it.
Brian Levin is a professor of criminal justice and director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino. He's with us to talk about radicalization online after the mass shooting in New Zealand. Coming up, a new study says maybe cut back on the eggs. We'll talk about what it found and how to sort out contradictory scientific findings when it comes to the food we eat. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow after 6 on The Morning Show, what would life be like if you lived to be 100? Kate Archer-Kent's guest tried to answer that question by talking to people who lived into their triple digits. Find out what she learned tomorrow morning at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now, new research is rekindling the debate over the nutritional benefits of eggs. A study from Northwestern University that looked at the health histories of 30,000 adults found that those who ate 2 eggs a day were at a 27% higher risk for heart disease. 3 years ago, however, the federal government loosened its guidelines for dietary cholesterol found in foods like eggs. So what's the healthy answer, and how should we sort through nutritional studies that seem to recommend different things? Thomas Sherman is a professor of pharmacology and physiology at Georgetown University Medical Center. Tom, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
Let's start with eggs before we move into wider issues of how we sort out what's out there in the media. This Northwestern study found, all right, higher risk for heart disease for people eating a couple eggs a day. Researchers noted eggs weren't necessarily the cause of that. What was your reaction looking at that study?
Well, I was fairly surprised because, you know, there are several factors that enter into something like this. And I thought that we had sort of moved past talking about cholesterol, but in fact we haven't, and it's a complicated topic. And I think eggs in particular are of interest to people because they're widely consumed, and they really are one of the highest concentrating forms of cholesterol in the diet. So I think that's why there's as much focus on them as there is.
I'll say, as someone in the media, one of the most common complaints I hear about media and science reporting is the eggs. And what are we supposed to do? We hear they're good, they're bad. What's your takeaway for now? You're not, as I understand it, running home and throwing your eggs in the garbage.
No, I'm not, but I think the study does give pause. It's actually among these types of studies. It's a pretty good study. It's fairly comprehensive. It's much, much longer term than other studies, which I think plays into part of the strength of it. But it does give pause. It's not a huge increased risk in heart disease, but given that heart disease is the number one killer of Americans, you know, I think it is something that people should pay attention to. And so that's why I think it's important. It contributes to one of the more frequent causes of death in this country.
It seems complicated, though. Eggs are one of many substances we as humans eat, and eating is just one of our many behaviors that can have an impact on health. How hard is it to tease out what one food or another might do when it comes to something like heart risk?
It's very difficult. It really is. And there are so many factors that play into heart disease. Really, there's body weight, there's exercise, there's saturated fat, there's genetic background risks. There are just so many things you can do to decrease your risk, so many things that increase your risk. And diet is just one of them. And so I think looking at eggs as a primary cause of heart disease is just not accurate. But looking at eggs as a contributing factor in a society where heart disease is essentially an epidemic, I think it's an important issue to talk about.
A reaction I sometimes hear from people when we have back and forth studies on the same kind of food is they throw their hands up and say, okay, I don't care. I give up on the science. I give up on following this stuff. I'll just eat what I want. Do you think there's a way that people in the media can present this stuff that's a little less flabbergasting for people?
I mean, there really, really is. And it's one of the more difficult things I do when I talk to my medical students. You know, I'm very sympathetic. I'm very sympathetic with the public. I'm actually sympathetic with the media, because it isn't an easy thing to communicate. I mean, part of the issue and part of what's going on in cases like this is that doing human nutrition research is very, very challenging. I just can't overemphasize that enough. I mean, we're not an inborn strain of mice. We're not a group of animals that we can give a defined diet to for many years at a time. And so we really try to gather research in the best way that we can. And that's typically, unfortunately, questionnaires, dietary recall, which are all extremely fallible mm-hmm. and inaccurate. Wives overestimate how much their husbands eat. Husbands underestimate how much their wives eat. People can't remember what they ate yesterday, let alone last month. And so there is a lot of error in these kinds of studies. And so what these epidemiologists do, and this is a very responsible group of epidemiologists, is they just try to introduce controls and corrections and models to try to tease as much as possible the contributions of eggs.
Talking to Thomas Sherman from the Georgetown University Medical Center, looking at the latest in the story of eggs, a study from Northwestern saying, hey, wait a minute, regular eating of a couple eggs a day could boost your heart risk. And also more generally, how to interpret information, health and nutrition information, sometimes when we see what appear to be contradictory studies. Thomas, there is, as you were saying, a lot of gray area. We're still trying to figure out these difficult things. That said, though, are there some things in the nutrition world that we just know rock solid pretty much for sure that maybe we should be paying more attention to?
You know, I agree with that completely. I think that listening to what your mother told you and that eating a plant-based diet is really the way to approach. That doesn't mean you have to be a vegetarian, but it does mean that the bulk of your calories, the bulk of your fiber really should be coming sort of following a Mediterranean-style diet. And that doesn't mean a Mediterranean-style diet. It means it can be applied to almost any ethnic or religious or national cuisine, where it's a diet rich in fruits and vegetables, lean meats, seafood, vegetable and polyunsaturated fats. And that is, in fact, lower in saturated fat and cholesterol. You know, I mean, that's sort of the gold standard. And And there is a lot of room in that for accommodating comfort foods. There's a lot of room in that for accommodating individual tastes. I mean, one of the, I think, important things that I actually frequently say to my students is that, you know, it doesn't really matter if you're on an Atkins diet or a paleo diet or if you're vegan or South Beach diet or vegetarian or anything like that, because all of those diets are much more similar to each other than they are to the typical American diet that is very heavily burdened with ultra-processed foods and sugars. All of these other diets encourage you to cook. They encourage you to limit sugar. They encourage you to eat basic whole foods. And therefore, we should spend less time critiquing each other's fad diet and spend more time learning to cook and buying ingredients for food instead of allowing corporations to cook for us and fast food restaurants to cook for us.
And you mentioned sugar. We're probably never going to see that major study that says, yeah, you should probably be drinking more soda every day.
No, you're not going to see that study. I mean, that's something, again, that's pretty hard and fast. We do eat too much sugar, and it isn't as complicated a food as eggs. I think one of the issues with eggs and part of the reason why people are so attracted to it is that cholesterol is just a very complicated physiology in our bodies, and that foods that contain cholesterol are also foods that frequently contain saturated fats. They're all animal foods. And teasing out the impact of saturated fats versus dietary cholesterol and other choices that people make that impact their heart health is just very, very difficult. But sugar is pretty straightforward. And in fact, sugar is really the only food group that is unambiguously associated with excessive weight gain. And that's not really true for any other food, although pizza is going to soon be added to that list, I think.
Pizza specifically?
Yeah, pizza. We just eat too much pizza. And it's not that I'm not a fan of good pizza. It's just that people eat too much of it. So it's interesting. Sugar and these sort of very calorically dense foods, we just eat too much of.
We're talking to Thomas Sherman, professor of pharmacology and physiology at Georgetown University. Our starting point, we're looking at nutritional research in light of a recent study on eggs and their relationship, their potential relationship with high cholesterol and heart disease, but moreover, how to look at dueling nutritional information and make smart food choices. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you ever feel confused or exhausted by the amount of nutritional recommendations we see in the news? Maybe on different sources like social media? Have you changed your diet based on a new study? Have you made it a point to limit foods that are higher in cholesterol, things like eggs? What questions do you have for our guest about nutrition, food research, how it's done, and what we as food eaters should do with all this information? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Thomas Sherman, professor of pharmacology and physiology at Georgetown University Medical Center, about nutrition, nutritional research, and how to make sense of what we see in the media when it comes to foods that are good or bad to eat. You can join in at 800-642-1234. When new studies or food recommendations come out, do you pay attention to them? Do they guide your food choices? What questions do you have about making sense of what you see in the news when it comes to food, or what you see on social media when it comes to food? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Tom, before we go to our callers, do you think we get too obsessed with trying to find either the superfood or the super villain food? I mean, a lot of the stuff you see on social media is always eat or don't eat blank.
You know, it's really true. And probably a week doesn't go by when somebody doesn't contact me wanting me to discuss some new superfood. And superfoods are typically defined as some new food that is particularly rich in some ingredient, a vitamin, an antioxidant, a protein or something like that. And they just don't really exist. And that, yes, there are foods that people should enjoy eating. There are foods that we should include in our diet. But there's no magic. There's just no magic in it. And we shouldn't focus on one ingredient when, in fact, a food can contain hundreds, if not thousands, of specific ingredients. And so by pretending that one ingredient is more important, we're sort of corrupting and exaggerating how much we really know about food.
Let's go to our callers now. Brian is with us in Madison. Brian, hello.
Hi.
Hi, Brian.
I recently read a book by, I'm not sure how to pronounce the name, but it's Nina Teichholz called The Big Fat Surprise.
Yes.
And she talks about how kind of this, the initial studies about the correlation between saturated fat and cholesterol by Ansel Keys were sort of based on a couple of really flawed experiments that then, and studies that then people kind of repeated. And I mean, the book is a little bit sort of develops like this cult following Ansel Keys did, but I was just sort of curious, like she really lays out a lot of arguments against the fact that saturated fat and cholesterol are even bad for us at all.
Brian, thanks for the call. Yeah, there's been a lot of back and forth about various kind of fats, saturated fats. What do you think, Tom?
Well, Nina has a real conflict of interest in pushing a hypothesis or a theory just to sell more books. She's part of a revisionist history group that is trying to disparage Ansel Keys, who is actually a fairly responsible epidemiologist, a neighbor of Wisconsin over there in Minnesota. And yeah, it wasn't a perfect study, but it was really one of the first international epidemiology studies that highlighted the impact of diet on cardiovascular disease. And there are many ways in which that study could have gone, but one thing which is unambiguously true is that whereas saturated fats are very complicated, there is no evidence that they're beneficial and that in many cases, especially in regards to cholesterol, there is a clear molecular mechanism by which saturated fats increase circulating cholesterol. And therefore, they are, in fact, a real risk factor for heart disease. And she's and it's just not a responsible take for her to take. But it is a big topic of conversation among many scientists and lay people.
I think among the public, there ended up being a backlash against fat, period, all kinds of fat. Are there good fats, I guess, is my question.
So poly and monounsaturated fats, meaning those fats that are found in fish oils and in vegetables and the like, really are shown to not only decrease blood pressure, but decrease cholesterol. And those are the fats which we need to eat more of as a nation and as a people. They are, those are the kinds of things you want to eat, foods that are rich in these leafy green vegetables, fish, things like that. And that, yes, everything that has fat has saturated fat in it. So I don't want to pretend like saturated fat is poison or anything, but you want the ratio of fats to sort of favor these unsaturated fats that help cardiovascular health and help blood pressure and decrease inflammation and things like that. So that's what we really should try to do. And instead of focusing on saturated fat, there's not a conspiracy out there to prevent us from eating saturated fat. We eat plenty of it.
Talking to Thomas Sherman, professor of pharmacology and physiology at Georgetown University Medical Center, about how to make sense of dueling studies, dueling nutrition information, what we see in the media, and what it means for what we actually eat and drink. We'll go back to your calls now. Joan is on the line in Eau Claire. Joan, hello.
Good afternoon. My question is about the studies that indicate that the French, who drank a lot of red wine with their meal, supposedly the flavonoids in the red wine bind with the fat of red meat or whatever, and and dispense that from the body. I'm curious about the doctor's opinion on that or feelings on that. And then also the grape juice. Can grape juice be substituted for red wine?
Joan, thanks a lot for the call. Tom, this is another one of the stories that we've seen again and again over the years. What are the benefits of different kinds of alcohol, red wine in particular? What are your thoughts on what Joan brought up there?
So this so-called French paradox has been around for a long time. It's really interesting, but it isn't going to be due to necessarily ingredients in red wine. There is one ingredient called resveratrol, which has gotten a lot of attention, although its efficacy in humans has really been zero. But in animal studies, it can be interesting. Actually, I think the best explanation of the French paradox is that they do in moderation what many of us do to excess, in that they eat smaller portions, they eat much more slowly, they eat much more socially, and that, in fact, in certain cases, alcohol consumption can also decrease cardiovascular disease risk. I mean, that's another topic that's complicated, but alcohol consumption, when done in moderation, can be very beneficial. So I don't think, again, that there's a specific ingredient that you can point to that is beneficial, although alcohol itself as an ingredient can be beneficial when it's done in moderation. And like you said earlier, many things in moderation are very beneficial.
Joan, thanks a lot for that call. Tom, I want to get into our national nutritional guidelines. I know you've been concerned about corporate influence on those guidelines in the past. One thing I read in an older blog post of yours, we specify good stuff to eat, maybe specific fruits and vegetables, but we specify ingredients, sugar, rather than naming names when it comes to products. Can you talk about that?
It's really true, and that industry does have an excessive influence over the dietary guidelines. And as we prepare for the 2020 dietary guidelines, I mean, the meat industry, the sugar industry, many of these corporate lobbying groups are just too influential. And it actually is contributing to this cholesterol. There's a value for corporations to create confusion, because when you create confusion, then people feel like they need to rely on experts. And on the internet, everybody is an expert. And so rather than just using common sense and eating small portions and eating a plant-based diet, they look for something magical. And it's, you're exactly right, that when we want people to eat something, we'll say, eat fruits, eat vegetables. But when we don't want them to eat something, these industries prevent us from saying, don't eat as much sugar, don't eat red meat, you know, those sorts of things. Instead, they say, limit saturated fat, limit, you know, sucrose. You know, many people don't even know what sucrose is or what a saturated fat is or what foods contain saturated fat. And many countries have these very common sense dietary guidelines where they'll say, look at this plate. This represents a healthy portion size. This represents good foods. And you want to limit red meat, and you want to drink in moderation, and these sorts of things. And these corporate influences really prevent that. And they do the same with cholesterol, because they don't want you to avoid red meat. And the egg industry doesn't want you to limit egg consumption. So it's in their interest to create confusion.
We'll leave it there for now. Tom, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, I really appreciate it. Good questions, everybody. And there's a million more out there.
All right. Thomas Sherman is a professor of pharmacology and physiology at Georgetown University Medical Center. He was with us to talk about nutritional research in light of a new study suggesting eggs might be linked to higher cholesterol and heart disease, a complicated issue to sort out. And he helped us sort out what to make of studies like this when we see them in the news. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, it's our weekly roundup of the top stories in national politics, including the latest entries into the growing field of Democratic presidential candidates. Anxiety has gone up a lot lately for teenage girls, according to recent studies. A psychologist tells us why girls are under pressure and how to help them out. Plus, the power of math might be able to help you get through March Madness and your brackets. That and more coming up tomorrow on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 7, a state lawmaker talks about new efforts to cut down on drunk driving rates here in Wisconsin. You can share your thoughts on legislation that's in the works. That's tomorrow at 7 on the morning show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll take a look at the state of higher education and efforts to get more respect for community and technical colleges in Wisconsin and around the country. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.